Hello and welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport on and off the field. I'm your host, Lisali Satali, and today I'm really excited to introduce our guest as she plays for probably one of the dream clubs to be at this moment in time. It's the absolutely wonderful Arianna Crisione. Hi.
Hi, Lisali. Thank you for having me. Thank you, everybody who decided to tune in and listen. I hope we get some interesting content.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on here. And as I alluded to there in my introduction, Arianna, do you want to tell everybody which football club you play for? Because I think this is the football club that everybody has all eyes on and absolutely is in love with at this moment in time in terms of your irresistibly cool brand.
Of course, I play for probably the coolest club in the world. Arguably the coolest club, whether you like us or not, we're definitely the coolest club. We've got the coolest hair. We are a global phenomenon at the moment, and we get to wear Jordan, so not very many clubs get to say that. I obviously play for the one and only Paris Saint-Germain.
Amazing, thank you. And so you're the goalkeeper at PSG, and do you just want to tell us a little bit how you got to be able to play for such an iconic European giant and sort of your journey towards becoming a goalkeeper?
Oh, wow. This is a long story, so everybody sit back, relax, and get ready, hopefully, to be amused and be reminded that fairy tales do come true.
Amazing. What a great setup. I love it. Carry on.
I actually just came up with that. I'm kind of pretty impressed with myself.
Me. I was going to say, the media training at PSG is lit.
You know, honestly, though, on a side note, I grew up with watching Disney cartoons, and a lot of people say that that's not how you should grow children, and little girls shouldn't watch princesses and stuff, but I totally grew up watching Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and all the princesses, and I am totally okay having Prince Charming, and I'm also totally okay climbing down the castle by myself and doing it myself, but no, I totally grew up on that, so I do think my story is a little bit of a fairy tale, and hopefully it will become a Disney movie some point when we win Champions League, but I will let the audience decide how they feel about that when they get to know a little bit more of my story. So I grew up a middle class, normal Southern California American kid. And luckily or unluckily, my older sister was put into football against my father's wishes, but my mother decided to put her in there. And that got the ball rolling in my family to play soccer. At the time, my dad kind of wanted us to be dancers and ballerinas. However, my coordination is not geared towards that. And I was not very good, to be honest with you.
And
so I followed in my amazing older sister's footsteps, and I got to join the local soccer team a year after my sister. And luckily for me, my sister was on the chubbier side, so they put her in the goal.
She's
absolutely gorgeous. Anybody wants to look us up, she's all over my Instagram. She's not.
What's your sister's name? Give her a good shout out now after you mentioned that. Come on, what is your sister's name? Let's give her a proper love.
No, Cassandra, she's beautiful inside and out. And now she's 4 years older than me, and people think she's younger than me, and she looks like she's in her 20s. So she's doing just fine. Nobody feel bad for her.
I feel like if she looks better than you, because you're pretty poster perfect, so I think like she's winning.
Definitely not, but she looks amazing, I swear. So anyways, though, so she played football, obviously, or soccer. As if I talk about the past, I will use soccer.
Because I think it's important to tell people that obviously you were actually born in America and raised there before you moved across the world, right?
And played. Exactly. Yeah. I was born and raised in Southern California, total SoCal girl, loved the beach. Grew up on the beach, played beach soccer, all that kind of jazz. But anyway, so yeah, so my sister, she went into goal, and because she's my idol, I wanted to be just like her even then. And so I convinced my coach, who never wanted to put me in the goal because I was tall and skinny, and in soccer terms in the United States, that means you're a forward, but I was also terrible at being a forward. And so I went in the goal, which I was not terrible at, merely because I wasn't scared of anything. And I would just fly at everybody head first. You're not going to go one-on-one with me, because I was just going to go at you 100% like a train. Got some red cards early on, learned not to go at them that way. But one thing led to another, and my parents were really supportive, and they got me the trainers that I needed and put me into soccer camp during the summer and things like that. And so my skill as a goalkeeper developed quite quickly, luckily. And my height was beneficial, obviously, to playing goalkeeper. Early on made, at the time, our youth regional teams, state teams, and national teams, and kind of moved up the line quickly. in high school, I was able to travel. I got to play in Brazil and Italy and go around the world already, which kind of probably opened up my taste for wanting to travel and continue to play football in different countries. And at this time, we have a great system, I think, in the United States where we can play university football. And I was recruited to play at one of the top universities in the U.S. where I made my debut as a freshman. It did not go according to plan.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Where did you go, if you don't mind us talking about that?
No, we can totally talk about it. I've already had my therapy. No, I'm just kidding. We played in the Final Four my freshman year, and I made a huge mistake. I went to clear a ball from my defender, and I completely whiffed it. So I just went to kick and swing and a miss. And it went into the goal, obviously. And then I turned to try to get it back, and I dove into the goal to get the ball out, and I landed in the net, and I was like a fish caught in the net. And all of it was on national television, which some people were watching that day. It was also played on ESPN. I made ESPN top bloopers of the year. My teammates were hilarious. I was number one that night for the week of ESPN bloopers, and then I was in the top five of the worst plays of the entire year.
No, that's harsh. Come on, that is a lot. That is harsh.
It's a really good story now. At the time, it was kind of rough dealing with it, to be honest. 18 years old and like, I did get a lot of fan mail at the time. This is before YouTube was even that big, kind of aging myself. I probably would have a million followers on Instagram right now if this was today, but Instagram wasn't.
Hey, you're growing up. How did you deal with that? How did you deal with that fallout? Because obviously it's incredibly scarring having this moment for yourself where you feel like you've let your teammates down and you've let yourself down. Because I've got to know you and I've got to observe your career. You've gone forward. You have incredibly high standards for yourself, right? You are looking to compete. You compete at a very elite level now, and you compete for, you know, the biggest trophies they are to play for. How did you deal with that first initial setback, particularly when you're still finding yourself, right, as a person at 18 years old?
I mean, honestly, I don't think I've ever cried so much in my whole life, and I'm not a crier. I think I later on in my story, you'll understand that I've had major injuries, and I don't think I cried as much as I did that day in that moment. I did not cry in the game. I just kept my head tall, and I played on, and we finished the game. And I played on. I didn't get taken out of the game or anything, but no, it was rough. I don't know. That was so long ago that I feel like I just had a great support system. My family was there for me. My teammates were there for me. My friends were there for me. And as a goalkeeper, you get scored on and you make mistakes and you either, you know, dust yourself off and get back up, or you have to kind of stop. You don't really have any other options, especially as a goalkeeper. You can't hide. You can't get back on the field and just kind of be there. You're either in the game or you're not. So it was a little rough after that, obviously, to go more into my story. I started my sophomore year, and my coach, I think she was a little hung up on that event. Maybe she wasn't. I don't really know. But I never played again, ever. So that was almost more harsh, I think, dealing with it.
Sorry, just to clarify, when you say you never played again for the team, do you mean you were never picked again, or you were picked but never put on the field?
No, I mean, I was on the team. You can't really kick somebody off the team just for making a mistake, but I never got back on the field.
Oh, wow. That's intense.
So again, I had to deal with that, which I think all these things, looking back, they made me stronger to be the person I am today. So I can't regret them or sad. They've all been, you know, that fork in the road that put my life on a completely different trajectory, that if it would have gone different, really literally, if the ball would have bounced slightly differently, or a bump in the grass, blade of grass would have pushed the ball, my life, I would not be here today. There's no way my life would have followed the same path. I just can't imagine that it would have. So because of this, I decided to transfer. Yeah. And at first I made a really easy decision, and I'd gone to a really top school in Southern California. So I had a good education and I got to stay close to my family, which were important to me at the time. But then I decided, okay, well, hey, that happened. Let's really mix it up and go as far away as possible and almost as different as the schools you could possibly do. And that led me to Boston. So I packed my bag and I moved to Boston, and I had a whole lot of other unique experiences at Boston. I got to play there. As soon as I got there, I actually set school records at the time, and I made a female athlete of the year. So it was kind of, I don't know how you want to say it. I can't think in English at the moment, but
it was kind of your validation? Do you feel like that was your moment of validation that you'd made the right decision to kind of put yourself so far out of your comfort zone after experiencing that setback and wanting to find a new way for yourself completely? Do you feel like you were vindicated in that moment of the decision?
Yeah, I feel like vindication and redemption is more than like validated, yes, but definitely vindication. I think that's a great word. It was almost like, look, I can play and I'm going to prove to you that you can't break me. And I think I've kind of always had that mentality that nobody will break me but me. Like, I can do that to myself all the time, but I will not allow anybody else to say what I can or can't do. And that definitely followed me throughout my career, whether that be a good thing or a bad thing. I can't say, ask me on my deathbed, but I've definitely led with that for quite a while.
Yeah.
And so at Boston, it was a little difficult, though, because I had taken the position of a senior. So her friends didn't necessarily like me. And that kind of led to me feeling like an outsider from the rest of the team. And I don't know if I had put myself in that position or if that's how they truly felt about me. But that's what it was. And so I didn't ever feel accepted at Boston, even though I'd done well for the team. I never really felt integrated into that team, which was really difficult because at my old school, I was really close to my teammates, and leaving my teammates was one of the hardest things about choosing to leave because I was really close to them.
How do you deal with that mental challenge? So you've come into a team, and as you say, you've displaced a senior who's presumably a favorite of the team in much the same way as you were at the previous team you'd left to come across. How do you deal with that initial mental challenge? What keeps you locked in to say, I'm going to stay here, even though I don't feel that sense of team belonging, I think is what you're saying, right? What makes you personally yourself say, I'm actually going to hanker down, I'm going to stay here?
So I think it's the same thing as before, that I didn't let the coach break me. So the team can't break me. They're not going to make me leave. This is where I'm at now. I'm going to play, and I'm going to play my best. And you let, like, love me or hate me, I'm here. And whether, again, this is a great quality that I have, or sometimes it's probably a fault, I think you can go both ways. Just kind of how I embrace everything. And that's what I did. And I did my best and I kept training hard and I found friends outside of the team and I found my own group and my own tribe outside. And that kind of kept me supported and going. And that's what I did. And I think that definitely helped me gain experience to understanding that you don't always get along with your teammates. You aren't always best friends with everybody. And especially playing abroad, once I went abroad, I found that the cultural difference in some clubs are not very open or friendly to foreigners. And so this initial experience helped me to be like, okay, I've done this before. I don't need to be friends with you guys, which is what I found when I inevitably went to Italy.
No, definitely. And I want to come on to talking about your experience in Italy because, you know, when we first connected and you told me about this, I found it incredibly fascinating and interesting given, you know, a lot of conversations about player welfare and club responsibility. But just before we go forward, I just want to touch on something there. It seems to me that you've always had this inherent form of resilience and inner confidence in yourself. Was there something that influenced that in your upbringing? Because obviously you've talked about your dad wanting you and your sisters to go and do sort of more dancing, ballet, but you switched that up and then you went to soccer, as you were calling it then when you were growing up. And you excelled at that, right? Because you decided to completely devote yourself to it. Where do you get that kind of drive from? Can you pinpoint that? Have you ever tried to understand? Because I think it's a phenomenal quality, by the way. And I think anybody, no matter what they're doing, needs to kind of learn to have that level of being able to quieten, you know, the imposter syndrome and the doubters outside. And I think, unfortunately, it's something that I see over-index in women like myself. And so how did you teach yourself that? Because I think it would be really good to try and understand what kind of motivates that behavior to try and, because if we could distill that and put that in a bottle, you'd be like a multi-billionaire. You'd make people too broke. Because if you,
I could teach people. I don't know. I can't pinpoint it. I was always a confident kid, and it wasn't, you know, when you're a little kid, some people sometimes called you bossy or something. I got called bossy a lot. And now I look at that and that, fine, call me bossy, whatever. Sometimes now I try to tone it down and then I think about it. I'm like, no, why? I feel like I was always just a confident kid. I always knew what I wanted or what I liked or, you know, what my favorite color was. And you could tell me what your favorite color is and that's cool. And I'm happy for your color, but you can't change my color. And I've never been influenced by the crowd for whatever reason. And I think it's actually ironic because my sister and I don't necessarily are on the same path as this. She's okay. not really influenced, but she's like, I'm definitely probably much more confident in some ways. And so clearly it definitely came from our upbringing in my family, or maybe she also pushed that on me too, to not follow her own path. And then my parents were always super supportive and very confident in us and teaching us. And we're really lucky that my parents valued education a lot. So we went to Montessori school. And I think this might have had to deal with that, though, too, of being independent and learning and enjoying learning and learning at your own pace and not being always compared to the other kids. If you were advanced in something, then you went forward. If you were behind in something, then they helped you try to catch up. And again, just my parents always, both parents supporting sport, supporting education, and very curious and ask a lot of questions. And no matter how dumb they were, my parents would answer them. They made stuff up a lot to give me an answer. My dad was great at that, really inventive and creative, which is probably where I get creativity from. But I think they just kind of promoted me to be confident in myself and to work hard to be confident. Like I can't be like I'm not good at dancing, and I can tell you that because I'm not. And so I'm not going to be confident as a dance. Like I'll dance and, you know, like nobody's watching and they probably shouldn't watch, but I tell you, I'm not going to enter a competition because I'm not going to win. So I don't know. I feel like people need to find something they are good at and then understand it and be confident and start at one thing at a time maybe. But I definitely think it's also the people that you surround you with that need to support you and help that grow.
Yeah, no, it's for sure. And I think, you know, if I can kind of summarize from listening to you, that it sounds like a lot of it was your mom and dad's ability to empower you
probably
to be confident in your decisions from an early age and giving you that unwavering belief that being unapologetically yourself was a good thing.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting to hear you talk about that, because the other sort of high profile American woman example I can think about who talks in this way is Michelle Obama. She talks a lot about how her mom and dad were really key for her and her brother to center themselves and understand that no matter what their background was, you know, even though they came from an economically disadvantaged background, whatever they had in their mind as the goal for where they wanted to be was completely possible as long as they worked hard and they stayed honest in their purpose. And it sounds like your parents kind of gave you guys the same platform so that you could succeed and chase those goals and be able to have a really good support network when things didn't go to plan, so that you knew you always had that fallback. That probably helped. Do you think that helped make you more daring at trying things like going to Boston?
For sure. Knowing that my parents, no matter what happened, if I fell flat on my face, my parents would help me get back up and my mom would dust off my knees and probably wash my dress because it was all dirty. And then she'd put me in another dress and push me right back out the door. So yeah. No, I definitely think my parents were an amazing support system, and my sister for that matter. She's definitely one of my biggest fans. And I think also too, the fact that my parents never tried to have my sister and I compete against each other. They were it was very important in my family that we were competitive in the fact that we both wanted to get better grades or something like that. Or we like joked about who got the better SAT score, but it was never a competition between us for our parents' love or to see who was better. It was okay. It's your sister's turn to shine, so you support her or vice versa. And I think my parents did a fabulous job at that. And so I think I am a supporter of other women because of this too. I don't look at myself always in competition. Obviously on the field we're in competition, but besides that, I don't think you gaining something or you winning something or you earning something takes anything away from me.
It doesn't detract from you. You see it as actually a really good win for collective groups, profile, visibility.
Absolutely.
And just whilst we're talking about, you know, one of the chapters of visibility and supporting other women, how are you currently feeling about the prospects of women's football? Because obviously we had this horrendous global health pandemic. You guys, unfortunately, you know, had a fantastic run in the Champions League final. I know you don't agree because you didn't come home with the trophy, but
yeah.
I think you made phenomenal strides in that competition. Unfortunately, you came up, and I'm quoting you here, on your nemesis, Olympic Lyonnais, once again, and unfortunately, you know, got knocked out by them in the semifinals. But in general, how are you feeling about women's football at this moment in time?
I think we're always on a pretty positive trajectory going forward. I don't think that's like a roller coaster straight up before you go down kind of trajectory of up, up. I think it's a slight up at the moment. I would like to take my hat off to UEFA. I think they did a fabulous job on our tournament, making sure we were safe, making sure we felt safe, having great facilities for us. The televised, it was even played in the United States. So I had friends tell me that they were able to watch it on CBS. things like this. So this was super great. I was a little disappointed during COVID. I thought we were on a higher, like a quicker trajectory of women's football coming off of the wave of the Women's World Cup. However, COVID taught me that we were not, that a lot of people who had talked a big game that was kind of just hot air, because as soon as COVID hit, a lot of people forgot about women's football. Again, from an economic business standpoint, I understand that that's not what builds money or makes money for a lot of clubs, a lot of business, a lot of things revolve around football, especially in Europe. Football is a part of the GDP of Europe. It's a very small percentage, but it is definitely on the radar of economists. And because of this, women's football, unfortunately, we are not there yet. However, I think there were some people that could have stepped up and made a little bit of an effort. And while I see this as an unfortunate event, I don't see this as the end or the downfall of women's football. I just think we thought we were a little higher up on the totem pole, and we're not. But I also think it's the moment to stop and say, okay, this is where we are. Now we know the truth. We know where we're working from, and we can push on from here and keep moving forward. And I think other clubs have stepped up and organizations, and there's a bit more visibility. Our games will be aired now in the United States too, from D1 Arkema for the French league. So this is a positive thing. The clubs are stepping up, and especially here in France, we didn't have any clubs that went bankrupt or anything because of COVID, thankfully, so far. So hopefully it'll stay this way and our league will continue in a positive way. But I think, you know, we're all suffering a bit, the whole world at this moment, for numerous reasons. And I don't think women's football should complain when there's so much else going on. I think we're in a good road.
Yeah. And just on that subject, you know, obviously, as you say, you know, having that sort of sadly, that reality check to actually kind of give you a real thermometer of where you've gone on the growth trajectory, because I was speaking a lot to Beck Smith about this and Maggie Murphy, who's the general manager at Lewis FC. And we were chatting and I was saying, for me, I felt like you got a little bit sucker punched as a collective within our sports industry, women's football, because other industries suffered, yes, for sure, because they were off. But I didn't see that level of turnoff that happened with women's sports, specifically women's football. And I can say that, you know, as a guilty party in this, working for a sports broadcaster who didn't step up in the way that we should have, you know. Mm-hmm. I look at that and I was very disappointed personally that a lot of us, particularly in the media side, where I think we could have done a lot more to keep up the visibility and the conversation, keep women's football in people's mind. I feel like it's a good reflection for us to take accountability and say to ourselves going forward, you know, how can we step up to better improve visibility for women's football? Because until we keep it in consumers' mind enough to be that cachet cool that has become men's football, and men's sport, you won't be able to make that business case to have that investment from the sponsors and also the club, you know, actually dividing revenue between you and the men's team in a proper way that allows you to thrive, because we are not actually putting our money where the mouth is, which is to say, we think this is a really good brand. We think this is actually a really good sport offering, and we're going to show it. We're going to build programming around it, and we're going to really help drive and tell the stories of phenomenal athletes like you. I think there does need to be a real confrontation actually in media rooms, because actually we are really responsible for a lot of the visibility around women's sport, which is another reason why I started this, because I feel like, yes, I complain about it at work and I talk to anybody who's going to listen to me. And trust me, I talk to a lot of people, but I was also thinking to myself, what do we actually all do personally around that to raise that visibility and that awareness of the great stories around the sport that are happening, because there's so many, right? It's so hard to choose, actually,
time. There's another point too, sorry, but just to go in on this, that didn't happen, so if anybody's listening, in the United States, the NWSL was the first women's football, soccer, however you want to call it, league to come back, and it was really depressing, the lack of attention that it got, especially at the beginning, because not only was it the first soccer, almost, well, Germany came back, obviously, and a couple other European clubs. But from the United States perspective, it was one of the first professional sports to come back. And a lot of big chains, I won't call them out directly, did nothing to talk about it. They were the only like live sport happening, and it was crickets going on about it. So this was super depressing, in my opinion, from a women's sport perspective, because it was a great opportunity for the big media people to step up and even 5 minutes during one of their broadcasts to talk about it, or to give some attention or some social media outlets to to show the great goal or the great saves that were happening during this tournament. So I think that was really an opportunity missed by a lot of big, big media outlets.
Yeah, no, I would agree on that. And I would say that the media attention for me only dialed up when, again, and this is when I talk about male allies and male investors coming into women's sport to really show the credibility, because unfortunately we are in a system where that still is the case, that we are needing them to pay it forward, you know, both in words, but also actions and actual investment, until, you know, you had Alexis O'Hane, you know, buy that stake and then make his daughter the young franchise owner, Serena Williams, who's always been, you know, a great poster girl for women's sport. But I do think we need to get away from that and create more Serenas and find a way to elevate and create those platforms, because it's quite clear she's the biggest, best business case you could ever have for why you should invest in women's sport, right? I always say, people say, what is the best of, and I'm like, oh, Serena Williams, you know, the one that you put out everywhere as, you know, the token female that you support in sport. Imagine if you properly invested in growing, publicizing, and making more platforms to create participation at elite level, right, the way to grassroots, how many more would you get?
Well, I think too, there's obviously, I compare a lot to the United States, but it's an overarching theme. In my opinion too, especially in women's sport and especially in women's football, you have so many people that know the U.S. national team players or the national team players for a country, but the leagues and the clubs make up so many more players that truly make the leagues, and without them, there would be no league. You can't just have the 11 players from the national team. And I think these get forgotten a lot, and especially during the media, they only focus on those stars that play for their national team, where when you think about the NHL or Major League Baseball or NFL and male teams, you know a lot of players on that team. It's not just the top stars. If it's your favorite team, you know the whole squad. And I think a lot of women in collective sports get lost in the media, in the production, in a lot of things. If you're not the top 2-3 players on that team, you're just not there. And I don't think this is right at all, just because there's so many women that play and there's so many women that create the team, that create the sport, that we need to give value to, that are forgotten.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you on that. And that comes back to that question of saying there needs to be a more strategic, well thought out idea as to how you start to do the storytelling to raise the visibility and awareness of all those women. And just as you've been going through your career, obviously you've gone to different leagues that have given you that experience where you can make these comparators. And one of those leagues that probably, I would say, made the biggest impression on you from the way we've talked has been your experience playing in Italy. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and the kind of learnings you got from that experience of going there?
Absolutely. So I think maybe just to give a little bit background on how I even got to Italy, I have, obviously my name is Italian, so I have an Italian background. I knew I wanted to play in Europe, and at the time the league didn't exist in the States. So once I graduated from university, I came abroad. I first went to Sweden because I couldn't get to Italy, but my dream had always been to play in Italy. For whatever reason, it was the pinnacle of football to me. Just the men's national team had won the World Cup recently. That also ages me. family heritage and a bunch of stuff. So I did everything I could to get my Italian passport. And when it finally came through, that's when I contacted the Italian clubs to get to Italy. And playing in Italy was an experience on so many levels. I actually did Erasmus, so I had lived in Italy already, and it was nothing, not comparable whatsoever. When I finally did move to Italy, I moved to an island. I got island fever. It was very small. Couldn't get on and off the island very easily. If it's not the summertime, the island shuts down. But it was, looking back, it was a fabulous experience. At the time, it was difficult. Like, I didn't even have Wi-Fi in my apartment. That's like putting it into actual legitimate term. Like, I had a minimum amount of internet on my phone.
And how did you deal with that kind of form of feeling so disconnected, right? Because you're physically disconnected because you're in a space that, you know, has no kind of access to mainland apart from a boat, but you're also so far away from home, right, at this point, right? Because you've left for a couple years now, because you did your how many years did you do in Sweden before you moved to Italy?
Just one season.
So you'd had one season in Sweden, then you made your
season, and then the way that goes though too is the Scandinavian season goes through the summer, so I've been there from March until October, and then I went to Italy January,
because the transfer window
year, like the way it goes. So it was interesting, but you also have to think about that time. Obviously my parents had internet at their house, but it wasn't, this is this is like almost 15 years ago ish.
Yeah.
So at that time, like, it's not like today where if I went someplace and I didn't have high speed internet, I would freak out because I'm so used to it. Even then, I didn't have, I mean, I totally had access obviously to internet, but it wasn't the same. And not everybody was connected. So it's not like you were constantly talking to your friends and family. We had like AOL messengers, how you talked.
Yeah.
All this stuff. So it wasn't probably
now. If you're talking about AOL Messenger, that is like a good 20 years ago now.
Well, that was college. We had AOL Messenger. But even then, I think, no, I was like, yeah, you get where I'm going. So, I mean, my teammates hadn't even like been downloading music yet. To give you, my teammates would freak out if I got on the plane with my iPod and didn't turn it off during takeoff because they thought that I would ruin the radio frequency to the pilot and we would crash and die. Wow. Literally crash and die. That was their perspective at the time. So I was in like a different world and things were closed on Sundays. The supermarket closed at lunchtime. You had to organize your day if you wanted to do anything or get anything because, you know, things closed in the middle of the day. It was a huge experience, positive and negative, but even the negatives helped me grow as a person and understand coming from Southern California where I could get anything and everything I wanted at any time of the day to hanging my clothes out to dry. Never had to hang my clothes out to dry. I always had a dryer. All these little things that you don't think about to our team not regularly paying the bills of our apartment. I lived with other girls on my team. They didn't pay the bills. The landlord would come knocking on the door and would say, sorry, we don't even have enough money to pay you for rent. To the electric company turning off our water. Me boiling water to take a bath when I got off the plane from America. Lots of stuff that, you know, you learn how to figure stuff out, which in America, you kind of don't have to because you call somebody and it's fixed really quickly. And there it wasn't. So at the time, it was super frustrating, but it was also liberating and empowering, like figuring out how to get stuff done by yourself. So it was a huge experience.
How old were you when all of this was happening, if you don't mind me asking, just to try and get an idea of where your headspace was?
23.
So you've had to deal with a kind of a culture shock and adjustment. Yeah. And then you're also having to deal also with the reality of what you felt was a dream move in a very pragmatic way that's not got the fairy tale spin on it.
Yeah, oh no, this is not the fairy tale yet by any means. It's definitely like dealing with my wicked stepsister's moment of the fairy tale.
I love the analogy. And so what was the club's role in all of this? So when you guys are having these challenges where you're not being paid, I'm presuming, by them, which is why you're unable to meet your utilities. Where are they in all of those conversations?
Well, so technically, they paid our utility bill directly. Like the apartment and the utility bill directly. And then we got our paychecks, per se. But we would get our paychecks like 3-4 months late. And then even then, we'd get 2 paychecks. So you're always late. You're always behind. To put into perspective on this, when I finally left the club, I was an entire year of pay. I was missing an entire year of paychecks, even though I've been like paid at various times. Yeah. To the point of 3 weeks ago, I got a small check in the mail from money the club still owed me after I had to sue them when I left.
Oh my gosh. So what happens in that situation? Like, where do you go to for support as a young player? You're abroad, you're away from home. You've now come in new culture and you've got a club that is essentially neglecting its duties to you as a player. It's breaching your contract, your terms. Did you have a representative that you could turn to? Because nowadays there's professional football associations and things like that, these likes of CAS. Where did you have, where was your kind of your check and balance for the football club in this situation? Oh my gosh.
No, really, we had nothing. And even as a team, we tried to get together. We wanted to strike. But we talked about it, and if we striked at practice, that the club wouldn't care, they wouldn't pay attention. And if we striked at a game, so like we'd show up but not actually play, we were the number one team in the league, and losing that game could mean losing the championship, which would hurt us.
Yeah.
So we'd talk a lot and discuss and be like, well, is it worth losing the league and not going to Champions League next year, or not having like winning, because we all want to win, to get the club to maybe pay attention, or to get the world to pay attention. A couple times the girls wrote on their t-shirts under their jerseys and took their jerseys off when we knew it was going to be a live game to explain the situation. But to be honest, at that time, nothing happened. We didn't know I think Cass was around, honestly. I think Cass was there, but I didn't know what Cass was, to tell you the truth. Now there's FIFA Pro also, which helps players that, again, I wish I would have known about. I guess later in the story, I also have a master's degree in football business. So during that class, we have a class about the rights and of players and different rules and things like that. So during this class, I remember my professor explained that if you're a player and you have a contract that technically gives you enough money to live, you are legally a professional player. But in Italy, even to this day, they're still not considered professional by the tax man, by the government, by the league. They're not officially professional yet. They're discussing it. And I think, don't quote me, I feel like they're trying to become professional by 2021 or 2022 is the objective. But even today, like, Juventus is not considered an actual professional player.
The elite Serie A Femminile players are not considered professional according to the Italian government.
No, femminile, it's not considered professional yet. You are not technically, you're not professional. So with this statute or lack of, as I said, my professor explained to us, which gives you rights that we didn't know that we actually had, and we could have gone to CAS, and it probably would have been a lot quicker and faster and a whole lot of stuff. But at the time, no idea that FIFA Pro existed, that it was something that could try to help us. At the time, we tried to talk to FEGC, the federation, and the players union. And the players union did end up, that's the lawyer that I went through to go at the club. But I stayed there for 5 seasons, so I'm not sure if that makes me smart or not.
How long you stayed there for in order to, because I find this fascinating that it's like we're back in 2020 now, and this is when you're essentially getting, I'm hoping this is the last of the money they owed you that you got recently, or is they more?
I did not even know. I randomly found out that we were going to get this money. This was just like exciting. Like, I just got random money the other day. No, I mean, there's still so much more money, but I'll never see it. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And do you feel like things have improved now in terms of, like, you know, obviously you're at PSG and you've had experience?
No, at PSG, there's no problems like that. Like, on the month, like, you get exactly, like, it is perfect. You have a full paycheck. We're professional, like, nothing, nowhere near that. So anytime I am frustrated at times, like, you have to kind of think from where I started to here, like, there's no comparison. I would say that okay, this is not true. I still think Italy has some problems. Sorry if there's any Italians listening to me, but I still know of foreigners that have issues playing in Italy. France is a little different. They're much better. Strongly recommend playing in the French league, even if you don't. And then in France, it's not a professional league. There's clubs that are completely professional. There's clubs that have players, some players on professional contracts, some players not on professional contracts. That falls under the status of, like, the taxes and how much taxes have to pay, depending on your status.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure in England now, the FA, the league, they're doing quite well.
Yeah.
Had so many problems in Scandinavia. So I know in Spain, I think they're getting better. I know there has had been problems with some of my friends. I'm not sure their status at the moment.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I think it seems to me when I did a bit of research on this, that they're on at different levels of flux. And one of the things I was trying to work out was exactly that point you were making there about how some players on professional contracts and others weren't, and I didn't quite understand why that was. And so, just to get this right, so that we can, kind of close off, are you saying that that's because the clubs themselves have different tax arrangements for how they staff players on the clubs?
So, if you, for example, in France, if your players are on professional contracts, French taxes are very high.
So yeah, for sure.
If you're on a French contract, that means you're an employee of the club. You're employed by the club.
Yeah.
So one, if you get injured at work, it's like workman's comp in other countries. So if you get injured playing football, you can go on benefits from the government because you get injured at work.
Yeah.
But because of this, and also the amount of social money that the club has to pay into the system, into the medical system, it's just like an employee. Any employee, you have to pay a lot of taxes for. They have to pay a lot of taxes. So some clubs would say, okay, well, do you want to be on a professional contract? And then you're fully kind of covered on the back end, but we'll only give you $1 because we have to pay $1 in taxes. Or would you rather have $150 and $150 go straight into your pocket, but you don't have a professional contract?
Okay. But the risk for you to not have that professional contract when you are playing at elite levels, obviously very high.
Yes.
Because where does that leave you when you then get injured and stuff? Yes. Who has the responsibility for your welfare in that situation?
So I think I've never not been on a professional. Well, You'll have personal insurance. But for example, if you get injured in France, which I did, and I was on a professional contract, once my contract with the club was over, the government covered my paycheck, 80% of my paycheck, until I could play again. So I had a whole year of rehab where I was still getting a paycheck because I'd been on a professional contract. I couldn't go back to work because my job is playing football. So until I could go back to work, the government would cover me and help me. Just like if you work construction and a beam fell on you and you couldn't do construction, the government helps you until you can do your profession again.
Sure.
So if I hadn't been on the contract, I think, don't quote me, I'm not perfect on like French rules. If I hadn't been on the contract, I think the club would have ended up paying for my surgery and stuff like that. But I think they would have only been held accountable like for so much of my rehab. I don't think they would have had to cover my rehab for a year or until I could play again. I think once my contract was over, I think their legal obligation would have been finished.
Yeah. And just so I can understand, and if you can talk about it freely, of course, within reason, at PSG, is the ethos that they will look after you irrespective, or do they play by the rule as it would be based on what contract they sign you on?
Well, no. At PSG, it's a professional club. Every player in the women's team is on a professional contract.
Okay, great. So are you talking about prior to this, maybe when you were at Saint-Étienne, just so I can understand which...
Yes, okay. So when I was at Saint-Étienne, some of us were on professional contracts and some of us weren't. But for example, in League One right now, PSG is a professional club. Every player is on a professional contract. Lyon is a professional club. Every player is on a professional contract. Bordeaux, I want to say, is a professional club. Every player is on a professional contract. Montpellier is the same way.
Yeah.
I think that's it. Then you have the other clubs that have maybe 3, 4, 5 players on professional contracts. Other players on, I can't think of what the word is, but a dilettant, I think, contract. Different types of contracts, but they're not fully professional.
A semi-pro contract, or is it amateur?
Yeah.
Yeah, got you. Sorry, it was just to clarify because I was unsure whether you were talking about when you had your injury at Saint-Étienne or whether it was now.
Yeah, I'm discussing my injury from Saint-Étienne, but just as like PSG doesn't have this problem, like we're all completely professional players. I'm the only person that has a job with football, but it's my choice. I could live with my contract from the team.
Yeah. No, I wanted to talk to you about that. How did you make the transition into being able to juggle playing first team for PSG, who do compete on all fronts for silverware, as well as obviously doing the job that you do in the sponsorship division within PSG? How do you balance that? Does the club create a special sort of workaround to help you facilitate that? What happened?
Yeah, so it's quite a special position. The club created the position for me. Well, do you want me to go into how I got my position too? Maybe that would...
Yeah, for sure. Because I think it's a good learning for people to understand, because I've often spoken to a lot of athletes, female athletes, and they kind of have this tension to say, what do they do after they stop playing? How can they set themselves up to have a career within the sphere of the club or the sport that they love? And I think hearing your story and how you've worked that out with PSG can also give clubs the initiative that they need to be able to set these kind of opportunities up to retain talent within their clubs and their organizations.
So because of, I think it really kind of started in Italy, and because in Italy we weren't always paid and I didn't want to have to call my mom and dad to put money into my bank account, I looked to other sources to make sure I was getting money and I was living on my own 2 feet. And I ended up starting to teach English and kind of creating my own little company. And I had lots of English students and I worked for a school and I was just building on my own talent, what I could do and where I was and what I could do, how I could kind of hustle, just see how I could make my own money. Yeah. And that led me to trying to figure out wherever I was to do something extra with football. One, we have a lot of extra time and I don't like sitting around doing nothing. I really like feeling productive and like checking things off my list.
I can tell. I love that energy though.
And, you know, I don't like sitting down and playing video games all the time. I'm reading or I took online classes and I just like doing stuff. And I also felt personally as a player, I think it makes me a better player because I'm not only focused on the game. Once I leave training or once I leave practice, I can let it go and I can focus my attention on something else. And then the next day I can start fresh. It's not like if I make a mistake at practice, I can't take it into the business room. Like now here at PSG, if I had a bad day at practice, okay, I have to let that go because I have so much to do at work that I can't have this on my mind or I'm not going to get anything done. And I'm not telling everybody to do it because I'm not going to lie, it's difficult what I'm doing and it's tiring and it's not the easiest, But yeah. I think there's small stuff you can do next to your professional career that can help you, you know, just relax your mind, to learn something new, to build for the future. Because everybody's career is going to end no matter what. No matter what sport you play, even Serena, the greatest that we already talked about, at some point, she's not going to want to play tennis anymore. And I hope that's the way she goes out. God forbid, not an injury or due to something else. But you're not going to play sport forever. It's literally impossible. So we all have to think about that end day. And whether it's from an economic standpoint or just a mental to keep your sanity, we're not only our sports. There's more that we can do, and there's more that who we are. You're not only your sport. And I think also understanding this identity about yourself is really important and really helpful to start to build something else within your identity. So I'm sorry, got off on a little bit of a tangent, but so I kind of started to develop this in Italy, and then I played at a couple other clubs where I do some side stuff and some side projects with friends, or just try to create stuff, kind of the entrepreneurial spirit. My dad was an entrepreneur, so, and my sister is too, so definitely just runs in our family of creating our own business and doing things. So I ended up playing at Saint-Étienne, and I had a major injury, which led me to, I was out for 18 months, I completely destroyed my knee. And during this time, I ended up meeting my Prince Charming. And luckily, we stayed together after I changed to multiple clubs. But at a certain point in my career, I came back and we were living together. And he had the opportunity to go in the north of France for his job. And at this point, we kind of looked at each other, and I had the opportunity to go back to Scandinavia. But we were trying to understand, okay, but if I go back to Scandinavia, I was in my 30s, what's the point? I had played with the Italian national team, but that wasn't really in the picture. What's the point to keep playing now at my age? I needed an objective, a goal to reach for. Otherwise, you know, you're just going just to go, and that didn't really make sense. So we decided together that for us, for me, for our relationship, it would be cool if we could live together. So I would go north of France with him, and if I could find a club within the vicinity. And I was really lucky, and I did find a club that wanted to sign me. And I started playing with this club, and I absolutely hated it. Like, it was the second division, which is a good division here in France, but the whole atmosphere, just a lot of things contributed to me not enjoying myself anymore. And I kind of always told myself that when football wasn't fun and I didn't enjoy it, I would stop. Like, yeah. Not going to play to play. And so it was really unfortunate that I came to this moment, this realization, okay, this is just not fun. I'm not enjoying this. I don't want to be here. I mean, even in Italy, when like a lot of stuff was going wrong, I still loved playing.
Yeah.
So this happened, and trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. And randomly it comes across my computer, this opportunity to go to the Football Business Academy, which was a new program to help people and students and people already within their careers if they want to transition into the football industry, and to go into marketing, to go into one of my colleagues is a coaching director now, a lot of data analysts, a lot of different fields within this. So basically the best way to explain it, the program is kind of like an MBA, but revolving around football. So all our classes had to do with football. And it was just kind of a godsend that kind of trickled down, you know, it was the fairy godmother coming and giving me a little twinkle dust to show me, okay, that there's something else I can do. And the great part was, is even before now, we're so used to Zoom and doing things online, but at the time it was a little strange to do like real online classes.
But it was so new at that time. It was so new.
Yeah. You know, I was a little, not sketchy, but I was like, oh, is this thing real? But this also allowed me to finish the season with my club, because even though I wasn't enjoying it, I'm not a quitter. I started, so I was going to finish what I started. And this allowed me to do that. I would have class during the day and we trained at night, so I could go online to class.
Yeah.
We also had to go to China. So I did this really cool event in China, and I got to go to Hong Kong and different stuff like that. And that was a huge experience, really beneficial. And then the season ended, that semester ended. Had to do a second semester. And after the second semester of school, you go into an internship. And I was lucky enough to get an internship with Benfica in Lisbon, Portugal. And this started the fall. And so I kind of sat down again with my now fiance, and we talked about it, and we're like, okay, I was like, I really want to play. And he kind of is my reality check of, okay, but you've done that. What's the point? Don't you focus more on your education and really focus on work? Because when I'm playing, I'm very, you know, I'm in the gym after, I'm there before practice, I stay after to shoot. Like, so I was like, okay, you're probably right. So at the time, people would ask me if I'd retired, and I would say no, but I was like, I just didn't want to admit it. I think deep down I thought I had, but I was refusing to admit it. but I'd play pickup with the guys in the office, and I stayed fit enough as fit as I could. And then from there, we had to do our last semester. We had to be on campus at school, which was in Switzerland. So I had to move to Switzerland in the January, February, March period. Yeah. And I graduated. It was really cool. Got to do a lot of fun stuff. We got to do some great field trips, go to FIFA, UEFA, Juventus, really neat stuff. Got to go back to Portugal. And then I just kind of found myself sitting there like most athletes do. Wasn't playing. Still not playing until I retired, but I thought I had.
Feet. Is this the moment where you start to get itchy feet and you want to get back?
What am I doing? Where am I going? Did I ruin my life? I'm mid-30s and I don't have a job. Like, what was I thinking this whole time? And then me being me and not being able to sit down, I'm like, okay, well, I have to be productive. I can't just sit here and do nothing and wait for something to fall in my lap. That doesn't happen unless it's a Disney story. And so I just got really creative on LinkedIn and would reach out to everybody and anybody who would to have a conversation with me. And I just asked for a conversation. I honestly wasn't asking for a job. I wanted to understand the football market more. I really wanted to understand too the terminology, because I found it quite difficult. Every club has different vocabulary for the positions within the club. Could be had five different names in different clubs, and this was super confusing. So also applying for jobs, I never knew what I should be applying for. So I really just had a ton of amazing conversations, which allowed me to meet a ton of amazing people and do some really cool networking, which has been really beneficial now, to be honest with you. And it was also just really helpful, like, to get over that scared period of talking to people you didn't know and asking questions. And again, being a kid, I always asked questions and my parents always encouraged it. So I just pushed that right through to this. And I ended up having a professor call me and invite me to be a project manager. Never done this role. For the first ever standalone women's freestyle football championship. So it's the first time that women had ever had their own tournament. And this was a prelude to the Women's Champions League final in 2018. Right, I'm very confused because we just finished
2019.
Tournament. And I said, of course, love to. Don't really have much else going on besides chatting with people. So this could be great. Talk to people at FIFA, talk to people at UEFA. So it was also really funny because during this year, while I hadn't like forgotten football, I hadn't really missed training yet because I was still working on stuff, but I hadn't missed diving and like grass stains and bloody knees and all that stuff. And when I went to Women's Champions League, one, the freestyle athletes have this passion and this thing that reminded me of being a little kid and just loving the game for what it was. And none of the problems with being professional or not professional or your insurance or anything, just remembering. There's this thing that I say, because my very first soccer team, we had pink soccer socks. Yeah. So pink soccer socks is like being a child and loving the game. And it was also a thing between my dad and I, so just a nice memory. So it made me think of pink soccer socks. So seeing these girls and their passion like brought up this child in myself. And then watching the Women's Champions League final, though it wasn't the greatest football match, it made me truly miss the game. And it made me miss the fact that I never got to be in. I got to play in some pretty big stadiums and I had played Champions League in my career, but not to that level, not watching that big. It was like, oh my God, I want to do this and I want to be here again. So literally that night I got on the phone with my sister, always talking to my sister, and said, Sandra, I want to play again. I'm going to play again and I'm going to be in a Champions League final. And at this time I'm 34 years old, and my sister, who is amazing because she's like, maybe she's my godmother, I don't know. She's like, sure, do it. You can do it. Of course you could do it.
Love it.
So I woke up the next morning very ambitious, not knowing how that was going to happen, but got back on the flight back to France, and lo and behold, I had a first class ticket, which was crazy because obviously as the project manager and the job that I've been working with, they did not have money. I do not know how I was able to get a first class ticket. And as I was walking onto the plane, I saw a gentleman sitting also in first class who had paperwork next to him. And some of the paperwork documents I knew had been a part of the tournament. So I just started talking to him and asked him, had he been at the tournament? What did he think of Women's Champions League? And lo and behold, it happened to be at the time. He's unfortunately no longer with us. But Bruno Giroud, who at the time was the sporting director of Paris Saint-Germain, no idea who he was. No idea. He's an ex-player, quite a famous player. No clue. Probably that, but none. We started chatting. He invited me to sit next to him for the flight, and we just were talking about women's football, where I think it's going, what's happening, what, you know, my views are, how I think it could be improved, just lots and lots. And I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe, you know, he'll like know somebody that will help me get a job or something to that effect. And at a certain point, I had to use the ladies' room. So I got up. And when I came back, he was asleep against the window.
No.
Literally, that was a gut punch. It was just like, oh, man, my friends are done. Like, he's over it. And there must have been only like 15 minutes left of the flight. And literally, and this is why I call it a Disney movie, out of nowhere, when we start to hit the tarmac, it kind of bounces. And he bolts up and looks at me and goes, so do you want to play again? And I'm sitting there in my mind again, the little girl with pink socks is like, yes, yes, yes. Just say yes. Who cares? Where he wants you sign a napkin right now. And the more down to earth, thank you, my fiance, who's always in my head being like, okay, what's the objective? Where are you going with this kind of thing? Was like,
Keeping you grounded, right? Keeping you grounded and making sure you get a good deal.
Definitely in the clouds, and he helps me balance between the two.
Yeah.
So I looked at him and in so many words said, of course I do. But, you know, I just got a degree. It's been 4 months now, I think, at this point that I haven't been able to find a job. Playing just for a year just to play. I knew I wasn't going to be starting at that time. That didn't really seem like the greatest decision to be out of the workforce again for a year just to play. Even though I wanted to, there's not the greatest. So I said, yes. But I really want a job too.
Yeah.
And he said, you know what? We'd love to get more women into the women's section. We don't have that many people working solely on the women's section. It would be great. Let me see what I can do. I just happen to be coming to Ren this Friday. Why don't we meet for coffee and see what happens?
Wow. So at
the end, I'm like, yes. Like the little girl inside me is just bouncing up and down. She can't stop. We get off the plane. And of course, my fiance picks me up. I'm in the car. Say, babe, you know, I sat next to Bruno Chéroux and he offered me a contract. And he's like, no, honey, I love you. But seriously, you're done. Your career's over, honey. You're one of those athletes that just can't face reality. No, like we talked about it, right? Like, so, and he's amazing. Honestly, this sounds like he's horrible, but my head can't be in the clouds a lot sometimes. So he.
I think you need to give your audience context as to what Thomas does so that they don't realize that he's not just beating you down. He's a professional coach, right? So yeah, I think
he works for Stade Rennais and he's a performance specialist and he understands sport and football. And he actually helped me come back and I wouldn't be able to play or probably run for that matter if it wasn't for him with my injury. So no, and he's super supportive. And he was the first person actually when I had my major injury to tell me I could play again and to have all the confidence in me that I could do whatever I wanted to do. So he's super supportive and he's actually amazing. Just at this moment, he thought I was nuts, which thousands know. This is one of the biggest clubs in the world. Like you don't just get a contract because you chat with somebody on a plane. It's not normal. He also, by the way, just to make the story even funner, regularly tells me that it's weird for me to talk to people because French people don't do that. And that I talk to people too much. And that I talk about like life too much. And now he actually says I can talk to whoever I want and that I should keep talking as much as possible. So
I was going to say, otherwise you would never have completed your fairy tale if that there wasn't that.
Exactly. So long story short, clearly we all know where this goes. Bruno came back. He talked to the club. He talked to the goalkeeper, the coach. Everybody liked the idea that I would have two full contracts doing two different things. It was the first time the club had ever done this, something like this. And this goes into what we were discussing before, though. Because of this, football is number one. So I never miss practice. I never miss anything that has to do with football. I have to do my work schedule around football. But obviously, they don't expect me to be in the office every single day. I'm lucky that we have an office that I can use at our training center. We also have our main office of PSG in Boulogne-Billancourt, where I'm actually at right now, that I can go to, and I have my desk there. And then I'm also allowed, if I'm really tired after training or something like that, I can also go home, take a nap, and then pull out my computer, which now everybody understands télétravail in French, but working from home is very possible and we can all do it. So that's also really helpful that I don't have this very strict schedule of where I need to be and when, besides football, I'm very open to working where I need and how I need to be. And that is my fairy tale. And it would have been the perfect fairy tale had we won Champions League this year and I was in the final. But I was one game off and we were at the semis. But, you know, I have this one last season to make my fairy
tale. Well, I'm tipping you for next season. You're my bet. So I think you need to get it on. I mean, my team since I was a kid, AC Milan, also going to be there, so I'll be a little bit conflicted, but because I'm a big fan of yours, Ariane, I will root for you for sure.
Thank you.
And now when you're sort of like looking back on everything you've been through and you're looking forward, you know, obviously the big goal next year, before I think you were saying you are now maybe contemplating officially going.
And no contemplation. This is the last year that I will put on my gloves and lace up my cleats.
So this is on record now. We've got it.
I'm at a really good place, I think, in my career, and I want to go out on my terms, and I'm good with it. Like, I think I've done everything. Well, when we win the Champions League this year, I will have, you know, hit all the objectives that I could have or wanted to, and I will definitely go out the way I want.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear. And what is it that you want your legacy to be like? So when it's all said and done, you've got that shiny Champions League trophy. You're looking on 10 years from today, what would you like people to remember you for? What would you like someone to, you know, when you're sitting there on the plane in first class, what would you like to overhear someone say about you?
I mean, I feel like in 10 years, I don't think my legacy will be done, because I'm going to stay in football and I want to continue to work in football and develop women's football. So by no means do I think this is the end. This is not the last time you will hear my name. And also, I mean, I'm not the star player by any means on my team. I leave that to some of the other beautiful, amazing women on my team. So I'm not ridiculously famous. And you used the word phenomenal, and that was, bless your little heart for saying that about me. But I don't necessarily look at it like that. But I think there's much more that I can accomplish in the game. It's not necessarily going to be in the field. I make a joke, but I'm going from the locker room to the boardroom. And I think in the boardroom, I can make a lot more difference. And I think my legacy is that I'll leave the game better than I found it.
Yeah. No, that's great to hear. And I have to tell you that, unfortunately, your last comment there cost you a $50 fine. I have a fine system, Ariana, on my podcast. When anybody makes a self-deprecating comment, you've made quite a lot.
No, that's not self-deprecating. This is what we went to before. Just like I said, I can't dance. I can play goalkeeper. I just don't know if we would say phenomenal. I feel like phenomenal is like top 10 in the world. And unfortunately, my career did not go in the direction where today I am top 10 in the world. Had, you know, the ball bounced a different way, or if I would have changed teams earlier, it could have happened. My confidence is at that level that, you know, my skill set were there. I just, unfortunately, that's not the way the cookie crumbled. But yeah, I don't think that's self-deprecation. I think that's realization and honesty.
I'll be clear. When I referred to you as phenomenal, I meant you as a person as well.
I totally agree. I'm amazing.
To be clear, because as you said, you know, athletes need to be beyond more than their sport, right? You need to have a bigger why that's more than you just playing between the sticks. And that's what I meant. I think it's fair to say that people could describe you as phenomenal. The fact that you hold down a full-time job playing for a big European team, even though you're not the starting goalkeeper, I think there's still goalkeepers around who want that. And then you're also working in one of the most innovative sponsorship teams in sports. When you consider the partnerships that PSG are brokering around the world, it is actually changing how sports teams and sports entities and actual lifestyle brands are thinking about interacting with sports. So I think you're in a pretty phenomenal space. So that I choose my words pretty carefully. Trust me, a lot of men who I work with will tell you I did not give out compliments.
Okay, I totally agree with you.
A lot of my colleagues, they'll be listening, they'll be like, enjoy it while it lasts, because when she tells you that you're not doing a good job, you're going to know all about it. Trust me. So I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to sit through and talk us through your journey and the wonderful, beautiful roller coaster ride of a fairy tale that you've had. I wish you all the very best for your final playing season, and I'm so excited to see what you're going to do off the field, because I have no doubts in my mind that you're going to absolutely kill it.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I think, though, that my fairy tale is not over. And when the season ends, I think there's a lot to come, honestly. My path is taking some forks and some switchbacks and a whole lot of stuff, but there's definitely more to come. And I look forward to crossing paths with you again, and hopefully we can do some cool stuff together and get more analysts to pay attention to women's football and positive things in the game and a whole lot of other stuff.
Yeah, I have so many ideas for how I would like to work together, so do not worry about that. So I just want to say thank you to everybody for tuning in to another episode of In Her Corner. I've been with the Absolutely, and I'm going to say it again, phenomenal, Ariana Crisione. Thank you.
Thank you so much.